Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back our guest co-host, Dr. Stephen Hooper. Welcome, Stephen.
Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. We've got actually a wonderful guest today that we've had a recent conversation with, Dr. Nina Shapiro, Director of Pediatric Otolaryngology, otherwise known as ENT, Ear, Nose, and Throat, and professor at UCLA's David Geffen School of Medicine, about a new book she wrote called Hype, A Doctor's Guide to Medical Myths, Exaggerated Claims, Bad Advice, and How to Tell What's Real and What's Not. But first, we have some actually interesting research that matters. And the very first one is about teenage girls and sleep. What do we know about this research? What are they even looking at?
Well, I know you were threatening to say this is a so what paper, but I do think there's a couple of key factors here. And one is it goes right to the heart of that there are gender differences in research, and that males and females are not the same with many of these biologic factors. And that goes to the heart of the research in terms of we need more of these kinds of studies to point this out. This study is important because it speaks to daytime sleepiness. It speaks to how that can interfere with school functions, personal activities such as social interactions, and in many instances can be a mask for ADHD.
Right, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And in this particular research, they actually had 731 adolescents, 311 boys, 420 girls. They were all teenagers. And they had a questionnaire about their sleep and daytime functioning. And as you indicated, the teenage girls showed a lot more difficulty staying awake during class in the morning, class in the afternoon, and doing homework hours than the boys. Girls felt more tired, and then those who were felt more tired, they actually missed more school and were less motivated in school, suggesting that there's something going on here.
Potentially, absolutely. And again, the importance of looking at gender differences. And we also have to remember the developmental epoch is teenage years. We don't know if this is going to generalize to the younger boys and girls, or perhaps older teenagers and young adults in terms of the gender differences.
And we don't really know exactly what we may do with this, other than we do need to increase sleep of all kids who are going to school, because we know that they stay up way too late. This was published in the journal Sleep. Sounds like the appropriate journal.
Right.
You got to stay awake to look at it.
Absolutely.
Speaking of staying awake, the next research that matters is probably about like staying alive. And this has to do with hangover pills. And I would say most people who have ever drunk alcohol probably have experienced a hangover from perhaps drinking too much or too fast. I expect that this was perhaps the author of this article's experience.
You wonder.
You wonder. What were they interested in here? Because this was in a essay that was in a journal called The Conversation about research and about some research that this author and those that are doing it with mice to reduce hangovers in mice?
Yes, they were trying to examine this whole process of the phenomenon of a hangover. And they put together a medication you take by pill. And at the end of the day, they were able to take these inebriated mice and decrease the blood alcohol level by 45% in just 4 hours, compared that mice that didn't receive the treatment. And I think that the end of the day message here is that there may be a treatment for the symptoms of too much alcohol.
They believe that the pill they've concocted, I think it's a good word for what they've done, to have three natural enzymes that can convert alcohol more quickly. And so if, in this case, the mice, I'm not sure they chose to drink, but who knows how they got the alcohol. I hope they were all overaged mice, not underaged
and
mice.
And signed a consent.
And signed a consent form. But they helped those mice essentially break down the alcohol more quickly. I'm not quite certain how they knew that the mice didn't have a hangover, but I do know that they did have breaking down of the alcohol more quickly and the blood levels going down, which is what I assume they believe that the hangovers would get better.
The one behavioral marker was is the mice awakened more quickly following their drunken stupor.
Which is really good. This is an important research, I think, for other reasons, which is ways of helping reduce alcohol poisoning, alcohol intoxication, and to really helping one tool, and I say one tool among dozens that we need to think about, of helping reduce alcohol-related injuries and getting people, and if they do drink, to perhaps have a way of cutting down perhaps on the injury to the liver. We don't know if that'll occur. It's very preliminary, but we both like it.
Yes, and I think the one other message is the authors were quick to note moderation, responsible drinking in moderation. This is not going to prevent somebody from drinking too much, but it could lessen the effects of drinking too much.
So we're moving on to research I think each time is more impactful, and this next one I think is really impactful for any woman who's ever been diagnosed with breast cancer and those that may get diagnosed in the future, which is about early stage breast cancer. And do you need chemotherapy on top of perhaps the radiation or surgery that may occur to many of these women? And this was actually in the New England Journal of Medicine, and they're actually doing genetic tests to help determine those who are the highest risk, those who are the lowest risk, and in this particular case, that large group in the middle.
Yes, and I think you and I in previous shows have talked about precision medicine, and this is an excellent example of that type of science.
And basically what they looked at was this genetic test, and could this called Oncotype DX that can help put women into three different categories, and they already found out that those who are at the lowest category from the test don't need chemotherapy to their regimen. Those who are at the highest level do. And again, this is the middle group. And because chemotherapy can be toxic, the question is, did this middle group have benefit? Would they benefit from the chemotherapy? Perhaps not too surprisingly, because these were all early stage breast cancer, those in the middle group didn't benefit.
That's correct. The less aggressive treatment was successful for that group.
Yeah, and very successful. So it wasn't like the chemotherapy added to the success, and it has its toxicities. I guess the downside about this, because the take home is that this test will now be increasingly used, or a test like it, to help segment the women to determine whether or not they need chemotherapy. The test itself actually costs $3,000. They note the insurance covers it in many cases, but a lot of people may not have that type of insurance. And I do know that the makers of this particular test were involved in the study in some elements. It gives me a little cause for concern, but not enough to think that maybe it's not overall a good thing.
The independence issue, I'm sure, will be addressed down the line.
Yeah, so I think if you're a woman or a loved one who has someone newly diagnosed, be aware of this study. Our last research that matters really is about coffee. Do you drink coffee, Steve?
Never touch it.
Never touch it.
Stress-driven.
Well,
not caffeine-driven.
So I drink it all the time. And the question is, would you encourage your team, if they were working on an assignment, to drink it based on this research? What do you think?
Well, I think that ship has sailed, because my wife is a coffee drinker and my kids are drinking coffee now. And I do believe that there are benefits from drinking coffee. And as this study points out, one of them is it does make you more alert. And in instances of their study, it actually facilitated a whole host of other positive benefits.
This was in the Journal of Psychopharmacology, and it was really about kind of graduate students, college students, that the teams worked better. And I think this is actually very interesting, because it would suggest, should you have a pot of coffee if you've got a team meeting coming up? Because a lot of those people who may be having a little sip may be more alert, and things that keep people more alert, which obviously is a good thing, really does improve performance. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be able to hear a recent conversation we had with Dr. Nina Shapiro, Director of Pediatric ENT and Professor at UCLA's David Geffen School of Medicine, about her new book, Hype: What's Real and What's Not. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Stephen Hooper. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Nina Shapiro, Director of Pediatric Otolaryngology and Professor of UCLA's David Geffen School of Medicine, about her new book, Hype, A Doctor's Guide to Medical Myths, Exaggerated Claims and Bad Advice, and How to Tell What's Real and What's Not. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Shapiro.
Thanks for being here.
You know, I must say, this is something near and dear, what you're writing about, but clearly you didn't wake up one day and said, I want to write a book that really helps people understand what's hype and what's not. Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested in medicine and, for an easier way of saying it, pediatric ENT?
So my interest in medicine obviously started when I was younger, well before hype came to be. I have a family of doctors. My father and my brother are doctors, so I did have exposure pretty early on. And, you know, just I think a lot of people choose to go into medicine because they see problems and they want to find a way to fix it. They want to find a way to think about it and obviously to help people. So that was really my interest in deciding to become a doctor. Pediatric ENT is a very, very, very small field. There are hundreds of us, not thousands of us, around the country. And it's a part of ear, nose, and throat surgery. So you become an ear, nose, and throat surgeon first, and then you can subspecialize. And ear, nose, and throat surgery was very interesting because the anatomy is very unusual. The field in general tends to cover very healthy people with one little problem, say an earache, or very, very sick people with cancer, and really everything in between. So even though it seems very specific, it's a very broad field. And then I really enjoyed the surgery with children. You can make such a huge difference from the tiniest operation. I enjoy working with families. So it's a really fun field.
You're in an administrative leadership position. You're also a woman in a field that has a small number of people in the country. So you are a trailblazer, clearly in a family of trailblazers.
Thank you. Yes. I mean, when I first started, the field had about 10% women. And now it's about 30 to 40%. So we're growing as far as, you know, male to female ratio, but it's still very male dominated, as and with most surgical fields.
What's a typical day like for Dr. Shapiro?
So I have several types of days. I have my days where I see patients, where some of the patients are follow-up patients, and then new patients. And that's really, you know, kind of the fun and the mystery of this field, is we never know what new patients are going to come in. Some have relatively minor, although nuisance problems, such as recurrent ear infections, sore throats, stuffy noses, and then, you know, more severe problems, you know, bleeding problems, tumors, masses in their necks, acute problems, meaning emergency problems, such as, you know, a child who chokes on something where we would need to take care of it in the operating room. So, you know, the fun part is that we never know what our day is going to be. And then 2 times a week I do surgeries. So it's a really nice mix of a little bit of everything.
Given that your background, you graduated Harvard Medical School and Cornell University, and really training that taught you the evidence base of medicine, all of the scientific basis, but yet this book called Hype really is perhaps the opposite of what science is about. How did that come about?
Well, my interest in hype has been a lot based on my experience. So I live in Los Angeles. I work in Los Angeles. And I also live in the world. You know, everyone always sort of stereotypes Los Angeles as the place where all the crazy stuff happens. But it's really all over the place that we are hearing this information, whether it's online or from our patients or from our friends or from our families. And we start to question ourselves, maybe I missed something in medical school, or maybe I missed that new data that came out. And then I realized that people are just having so much breakneck access to amazing information, But oftentimes it's portrayed in a very inaccurate way and a very hyped way. So what hype is really just exaggeration. So things are portrayed in such an exaggerated form, and the listener or the viewer or the reader can turn this into something that is completely different and really get very misguided with regard to how they take care of themselves.
Well, we know right now people talk about fake news a lot, and you talk about some of the beliefs that you really are almost like conspiracy theories within medicine. What are some of the kind of claims that float around that listeners may hear about that you confront head on in this book?
So one of the biggest and probably one of the most dangerous claims that we hear is the link, cause, or association between vaccines and autism. And that really has devastated and I think has been responsible for some deaths in this country over the last several years. There was an erroneous paper that ended up being completely false and fraudulent 20 years ago that was published and then retracted from The Lancet. And ever since this paper came about, there's always been this question, and it's led to celebrities and the media and social media about this potential link between vaccines and autism. And there is no link, there is no cause, there is no association. So I think that continues to circulate. Even when people know and they've read and they've heard and they've listened to their doctors and they understand that this was a completely false study, they always have that inkling of, well, maybe there's still something to it. And I'm not going to have my child immunized, or I'm going to hold off or create a new tailored schedule for vaccination. So I think that's been a really, really dangerous myth that, again, 20 years later, it continues to circulate.
And not hard to put down, put to rest. I would imagine a lot of these sort of theories, they're fixed beliefs.
Their fixed belief, and part of it is that, and there was a study recently that came out in a psychology journal, they looked at groups of people who tend to have the idea of conspiracy theory, whether they have fears of conspiracy or concerns about conspiracy, they will also be people who have those similar conspiracy theories when it comes to health and a little bit of distrust. So, you know, it's kind of interesting that, you know, certain types of people tend to question things in a different way than other people. And again, I understand that people have concerns about vaccine injury, vaccine risks, and nothing is without risk. Crossing the street is not without risk. Everything has a risk. And there are vaccine-related complication and injuries, but these risks of injury are nothing compared to the risks of these illnesses.
Yeah, people forget about what it was like 50 years ago in many countries, particularly even the United States, with polio virus or other sorts of exposures. I wonder if you could just expand 1 minute before we take a break about this idea of risk. Because you say, you know, I love the titles of your chapter, by the way, and I'm going to use a couple of them. But you'd say, what does Ebola and your car have in common? And I'm like, I'm waiting for a joke to come here. But,
right.
You know, what are you trying to communicate there?
You know, that was actually one of my favorite chapters to research and to write, because we see risk in such funny ways. And I mean primarily in the United States, we love these exciting, dramatic, devastating stories that we hear about in the news. Ebola is a perfect example of this horrible scare. And, you know, we'll forget about the mundane, such as the flu or wearing your seatbelt or getting a flu shot or worrying about texting and driving, because that's sort of not so exciting. It's not a headline. But we do worry about these huge panics that are overblown astronomically. And so, you know, that chapter about where I try to put things into perspective and take a step back, and you don't need to be concerned about a lot of these wild viruses that are still so exceedingly rare, but you need to take some basic steps to keep yourself healthy and safe.
You mean like get your car bags replaced when you get a
when the
car agency sends you a note that says you got defective car bags?
You should listen to them. That's
you
not
listen
hype.
To that. Well, we're gonna need to take a short break, but when we return, we're gonna continue talking with Dr. Nina Shapiro, director of pediatric ENT and professor of UCLA's David Geffen School of Medicine, about her new book, Hype. You're listening to Your Health. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health. And we've been talking with Dr. Nina Shapiro, Director of Pediatric ENT and Professor at UCLA's David Geffen School of Medicine, about her new book, Hype. And Dr. Shapiro, right before the break, you were really helping understand that we should worry more about things that are common and really real, like car accidents and injuries, than things like Ebola, which may not affect almost anyone in the country, even though they could, I guess. And I guess I wondered, how do you go about changing, and maybe this book is part of that process, how people think about and understand what they should be worried about versus what's hype?
Well, you know, again, yes, I think the book really sort of helps people, and the goal is really to empower people that when we do hear of the next Ebola, because there will be a next Ebola type virus, just to take a little bit of a step back and digest the information a little bit differently, as opposed to hearing these horrible things and thinking that it's going to be, you know, their dying days. So, you know, I think what I'm trying to do is, you know, for instance, people panic about a symptom that they have because that symptom they've heard may be associated with a horrible, deadly illness. And so they will panic and go online and find their symptom connected to a deadly illness. So, you know, it really just gives some tools for people to be able to get a little bit of control about what they're concerned about and to not be so concerned about all these extremely rare events.
Let's talk for a second about common things and common things that you think perhaps maybe we need to set straight, one of which would be water, a multi-billion dollar business of selling water. I went to the grocery store today. I didn't want to buy the cheapest water. I didn't want to buy the most expensive. It was kind of like buying wine. You know, I didn't want to be the cheapskate, but I didn't want the expensive stuff. And it's just
right,
water.
Right.
What do you say, and what sort of things is your advice?
So water, again, is a multi-billion dollar industry, and it's brilliant. But for the most part, assuming you live in a city or a town where the tap water supply is safe, tap water is absolutely fine. You are not getting better nutrition from water. You are not getting better minerals or vitamins or any of that stuff that is added or taken away from your water, whichever direction the marketing is going, is utter nonsense. It's unnecessary. And certainly if you're thirsty and you need to go buy some bottled water, that's fine. Buy some bottled water. But it costs more than gasoline. And if you were to have told somebody that years ago, they would have thought you were crazy. How would you spend more on water than gasoline? And it's, you know, it's important to drink water. And I also talk about whether you really need to drink 8 glasses of water per day for health. And that is a little bit of hype there. But the supplemented bottled water industry is a huge money sink for a lot of people. And you know, again, it's fine. It's not dangerous. But you can save some money and just drink tap water.
Well,
get a reusable bottle.
And I love it at the end of each chapter for our listeners. And we will encourage people, because I think this is a book that can really help our listeners in your health. You have Hype Alert. And I love in this particular chapter on water, you talk about sparkling and flavored forms of water may contain nearly as much sugar as soda, and that you can get most of your water through food as long as you have a good diet. That seems like common sense, but may be things that most people don't think about.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, people don't realize how much water is in most of what they're eating. Even the dry food has some water in it, and that counts.
I wonder if we could go from one extreme almost to another, which is common to perhaps less common, which is things like cancer. And I remember when I was a medical student, one of the first research papers I ever wrote was looking at alternative treatments for cancer. In this particular case, I was looking at nutrition, and there just wasn't that much evidence that these things were working. How do you approach that, which is such a serious but oftentimes vulnerable time for patients?
Yeah, so cancer, people talk about the big C, and you know, and it is devastating to a family, to a person. And I think that, you know, oftentimes when people get that diagnosis, many people will turn to some sort of alternative treatment. And I think, and the data have shown that alternative medicine, complementary alternative medicine, has resulted in remarkable improvements in outcomes in cancer treatment. But the huge caveat is that it is complementary to standard therapy. So people do engage in other sorts of alternative treatments, alternative adjuvants to their cancer therapy, for instance, meditation, exercise, yoga, acupuncture, relaxation, some herbs, which, you know, I would recommend, you know, clearing with your doctor first, because even those can have some chemical impact. And that's wonderful. It really does help. And nutrition, you mentioned as well, really do help with outcomes of cancer treatment. The concern is when people use those alone without the setting of standard therapy. That's where we get into a lot of trouble these days.
Well, and you also spend a fair amount of time in the book talking about kind of dietary and aging, and you have a chapter when 50 is the new 40, and there's so much information. How do you tease your way through the things that you are concerned about as a doctor and as a respected authority nationally for patients, and things that you're maybe not as concerned about? And maybe an example of something that you are concerned about, like you write about testosterone in the book.
Right. So, you know, certain things, again, a lot of what I talk about is really to put people at ease, not to make them more anxious, not to make them worried or concerned, but really to put people's minds at ease and say, listen, most of this stuff is fine. It's not helpful. It's not harmful. It may, you know, may cost you a little bit, but most of the extra medications, or, for instance, bottled water, are fine and are not going to harm you. The problem is that, you know, something like testosterone for boosting longevity in a man is not something to be done without the monitoring from a physician. Even if you can get a lot of these supplements or additions without a prescription, you know, they can have some serious risks. And just because you can get it doesn't mean that it's okay without involving your doctor. So if you do have, for instance, low testosterone or low estrogen levels, supplementing your levels with a medication can be very beneficial. But again, it needs to be under the care of your provider, of your physician.
So one of the things that you clearly are advocating are doing things that make common sense, and exercise is common sense. But you also talk about hyped exercise. What's hyped about exercise?
Right. So exercise just seems like it should be all good. And for the most
right.
part, it is.
The more, the better.
Right. But there we go. The more is not necessarily always the better. So what we want is more people exercising more frequently. So adults, you know, several times per week, 30 to 45 minutes of vigorous exercise does lead you to a healthier life and hopefully a longer life. Children should exercise close to every day, 30 to 60 minutes of activity per day. But, you know, do you need to go exercise 3 hours of running every day? No. And again, you can do that safely, but then you start to get into some risks: dehydration, overhydration, muscle injury, joint injury, overuse injuries, even strain on your heart and your kidneys and your lungs from overdoing it. So we are a population of extremes, and, you know, it's really hard to find a middle ground when you are sort of erring one way or the other. The other thing is that people talk about, oh, well, I need to just exercise for 40 or 60 minutes and then I could sit all day. That's not ideal either, because we're finding now in some studies that sitting for prolonged periods of time without activity can actually have some negative impacts on your health.
Interesting.
So moderation, it's really hard, and it's not, you're not going to read a newspaper headline about moderation is the new exciting exercise, because it's not going to draw the listener or the viewer in.
Last question. What are three things that you do for your own health that you think are common sense and not hype?
That's a great question. So I exercise about 5 days per week. I do run, and I do run a moderate amount, 30 to 60 minutes, 5 days per week, and I think that's really good for my health. I do have a pretty healthy diet. I don't really eat meat. I eat a lot of vegetables and fruits. I don't really restrict anything, though. I do drink milk, so I don't think dairy is the root of all evil. I do eat gluten. So I have a very, what I would call a pretty moderate, reasonable diet, which also, I think, helps me stay healthy, and I get a flu shot every year.
Wonderful, simple, common sense. And I must say that for our listeners, this new book by Dr. Nina Shapiro, Hype, will be available. I assume they can order it in bookstores, they can order it online. We'll put a link up for those who would like to order it online and encourage our listeners to get it, to engage, and to figure out for themselves how to have a moderate approach that really can improve health. We got to thank you for writing such a book.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
We've been talking with Dr. Nina Shapiro, Director of Pediatric ENT and Professor at UCLA's David Geffen School of Medicine, about her new book, Hype, A Doctor's Guide to Medical Myths, Exaggerated Claims, and Bad Advice, and How to Tell What's Real and What's Not. We're going to take a short break, but then coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Laura, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. They can send any comment or question to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And we've got some interesting house calls today. What's our very first one?
The first one is, last year I was given a medicine called Zocor by my family physician because of high cholesterol. About 3 months after I started it, I developed really severe pain in my shoulders and thighs. My doctor said this was called myopathy and was from the medication. She stopped it immediately, but it still took 3 more months for the pain to go away. Is this common, and why did it affect me this way?
Well, statin myopathy is what we call it, these medicines to lower cholesterol that are really commonly used and rarely cause infections. So it's unusual, but it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. Sometimes people get muscle aches, you know, 2% of the time, 5% of the time, and usually you just stop the medicine and it just goes away. However, less than 1 out of 1,000 can get this really pretty severe reaction, but it can happen, and it can be really severe muscle pains and inflammation and even damage to the muscles. So sometimes if people are taking other medications that can interact with the statin, then maybe that interacts with the liver, and the two medicines together can be worse than either one alone, that can increase the risk. And sometimes if they're taking another medicine to lower their cholesterol, two different medicines, they can also interact and cause this. Some people have kidney failure. Some people have liver failure. Even people have thyroid disease. So, again, there are a lot of reasons why it's not really quite as simple. But it really can be really uncomfortable, painful, and it can last for a long time if it happens. You know, this is the sort of thing you really do need to get in to see your doctor. You need to stop that medicine, never be on it again. And then you might actually have to see with a rheumatologist to really make a diagnosis, get the blood work, and then if you need to have other potential medicines to counteract it, if possible, you might have to even talk about those. Some people think about, should they take this medicine called coenzyme Q10 to kind of prevent this? But there's evidence is not really great that that works for either preventing it or treating it. The best thing is the moment that you might have a side effect of any medicine, including the statins, if you're having it, stop it, talk with your doctor. Good luck with this particular case. What's our very next house call?
Not too long ago, I was traveling in my car and noticed back pain followed by sweats and a fever. I went to see my doctor, and after lots of tests, he said I had a kidney infection. That seems really strange, as I've never had bladder infections before. What do you think's going on?
Well, if the doctor diagnosed a kidney infection, that really could be what's going on. We assume in this case that there was a urine done and that maybe that looked like it had infection in it. Mm-hmm. You combine an infection in the urine with fever and sweating and back pain, we call that pyelonephritis, otherwise known as kidney infection.
Oh, okay. I was about to say, please don't ask me to pronounce that or spell it or anything like that.
No, we have to give everything a really, really fancy name in medicine. And the problem is that it's more serious if it's up in the kidneys, because that can get in the bloodstream a lot more easily than if it was just confined to the bladder. And our listener knows this because they're having sweats and fevers. That means it's in the
really
bloodstream.
Unpleasant.
Right, and it's bacteria that could be in the bloodstream or toxins that could be in the bloodstream. And it used to be this could be even fatal to people because they would not be able to control it. When four antibiotics occurred, this could be how people could unfortunately pass away. So I think in this particular case here, getting it diagnosed early, getting on the antibiotics, assuming our listener could actually swallow antibiotics.
Right.
And the doctor gets the antibiotic that the bacteria is sensitive to.
Sure.
And that you get better. It's really important that to know what's getting better here. Well, you feel better. You may still have fever for maybe up to a week. And a lot of times we think, oh, my fever goes away, I'm getting better. Here you may get better before your fever goes away. We'll help our listeners well on their way to getting better. What's our very next house call?
I had surgery recently on my back, and 5 days after the surgery, I developed redness and swelling around the area. The doctor said I might have MRSA. And they seemed really concerned. They said I might even have to be hospitalized. Why can't they just treat this with antibiotics first?
Well, first off, ouch.
Yeah, no kidding.
Does not sound fun. First off, surgery on the back can't be fun.
No.
That means you probably had a disc or some other problem. And second off, there's an infection. Now, whether it's related to the procedure or not, we don't really know. But anytime you've had an infection right after a procedure or in the skin lines of where that procedure occurred, it's worrisome because that means something's, you know, not right.
Yeah, you got to take red, that really seriously.
Swollen, and it can open up. And in this particular case, if it was in the back and near the spinal cord or canal, that would make me even more worried. I think in this case, if they were worried about MRSA, maybe you've had MRSA, that methicillin-resistant staph, what we call that MRSA, that resistant organism. Maybe you've had it before or not. But it happens frequently enough, I think, that's really wise for the doctors here to be concerned. I think starting you quickly on medicines that can treat the MRSA or the cellulitis there and seeing you back really quickly to make sure you're getting better and that you don't need intravenous antibiotics, because getting intravenous antibiotics could be life-saving and certainly prevent it getting worse if needed. What's our very last house call?
I had a stroke recently, though it wasn't too bad. Most people who saw me wouldn't even know, but I'm having difficulty, particularly with my energy level, and I'm not able to talk exactly like I used to. How long do you think it might take me to recover?
Well, again, we have something serious here, which is a stroke.
Right.
But we also know that, you know, a lot of people have strokes and can get, you know, better. And in this particular case, it sounds like a lot of people can't tell you've had the stroke.
Yeah, that's encouraging.
That's really
ways.
Encouraging,
yeah.
Right. It means it probably wasn't a large stroke.
Right.
And you know it's a little bit different. And I like to say, you know, strokes can be like a serious illness. They can be like a really bad pneumonia. Mm-hmm. They can be like a surgery that it might take you 6 weeks, 2 months, 3 months, even 6 months to fully recover, depending on how large. In this particular case, I wouldn't be surprised if you're not back to your energy level for 3 months.
Yeah.
And you probably are going to need things like physical therapy and occupational therapy, maybe speech therapy, maybe other types of support that's there. And you got to take the time to heal, just like you wouldn't expect someone that had pneumonia to go right back in and look and feel normally.
Right, exactly.
Makes interesting. Well, we want to thank our listeners today for their questions and concerns, and we hope we've addressed issues that are important to your health listeners. If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, you can send it to yourhealth@unc.edu or follow us online at yourhealthradio.org, Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guest today, Dr. Nina Shapiro. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. We look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.